Well, I'm very pleased to welcome here to the studio Rob Cantor and Julia Whittington. Julia has been here before quite a few times. She's clinical assistant professor in the College of Vet Medicine here at the U of I. She's a doctor of veterinary medicine. She's also the director of the Wildlife Clinic in the College of Vet Medicine. And this is the place where, among other things, they take care of injured wildlife. So if you've got an animal that is hurt, that's around here, that's where they're going to end up. It's a special, very special kind of thing that she does. And I'm also very happy here to have, for the very first time on the show, Rob Cantor. He is, and I want to make sure I get this right, communications coordinator for the University of Illinois School of Earth Society and Environment?
That's right.
Okay. And also, people who listen to the station will know him for this regular commentary that we air on Thursdays as part of All Things Considered. It's called the Environmental Almanac, and then that's also printed in the newspaper, in the News Gazette, dealing with features of the local environment in the central part of the state. And I'm real pleased that you could be here. Thanks.
Thanks, David. I'm glad to be here.
Well, one of the things that we said we thought we'd like to talk about is birds. And occasionally we like to do that on the show. People love to talk about birds they have seen. They like to ask questions because people will see a bird and say, well, here's kind of what it looked like. What is it? And we know people always want to welcome them to their yards. And I guess I'm always surprised by how many people are interested in birds and birding and how that's, I think it's supposed to be one of the most popular hobbies in the United States.
Everybody's a birder, David. They just have different levels of experience.
I see. Well, tell me about yours. I think this is something that you're an aspiring or junior birder or birder in progress, right?
I don't think I'm a junior anything anymore.
But okay.
I don't... I've been a birder for probably 20 years or so now, and to me, there's not much distinction between birding and going about my everyday activity, because unless I'm locked in a windowless room like we are now, I'm looking out the window to see the birds or listening, you know, for what's singing as I walk.
Yeah, and I think probably people might almost be surprised. I think the thing is that we go through life, so much of life, not really looking. You know, and if you look, they're there.
They are. They're all over the place. I think when it really hit home for me and how special each individual species of bird is, was when I first started my association with the Wildlife Clinic, taking the ornithology courses and always having that interest, but being really unaware of the diversity of species that we can see in our backyard even, was when I first became involved in the Wildlife Clinic. And my very first case was a common grackle, but what an amazing bird that was. And I think that if we simply open our eyes and open ourselves to what's in our own backyard and our own environment, we're going to be surprised at the diversity of species we see and how ultimately awesome they are.
Yeah, well, okay, now let me ask you about the grackle, because I think a lot of people would say they're not particularly attractive and that they're not, oh, you should see the look of horror on Rob Cantor's face right now. That, you know, it's not going to be on anybody's list of nice, pretty birds. I'm sorry.
Well, I would have to say that's because they haven't met one up close and personal. If you actually look at many of the blackbirds that we see in our area, they are amazing. Grackles themselves have this beautiful iridescent purple color to their feathering. European starlings, an invasive species not native to North America, is gorgeous in its winter plumage. So there are many birds that, while we might consider them to be pests and in fact may actually be harmful in some situations, do have very beautiful qualities and a place in our environment.
Sure. If you called the common grackle the iridescent purple-headed grackle, I think it would help a little bit.
Marketing. It's all about marketing, isn't it? Tell me about... I want to talk about the snowy owl that has been in the news so much. Snowy owls have, in fact, been in the news because these are birds that we don't often see. It's pretty unusual for them to be around. Why does anybody know why it is that we're seeing so many of these birds?
Well, I've seen national reports. I've seen scientists quoted as saying that there was a superabundance of lemmings where the snowy owls breed in the Arctic, And so that led to unusual success in raising young this year. So a nest that instead of having one young bird survive, had three young survive. And so you have all of these extra birds looking for a place to hunt this winter. I talked to Mike Ward when I was working, and Mike is an avian ecologist at the U of I. I talked to him when I was writing the story about it, and he said, well, the evidence isn't all in for that yet. And that another possible explanation is that it's just really a bad year for finding food where the snowies normally are. And so they've been forced down here. In either case, these are birds that are out of their normal winter territory, the ones that we're seeing.
Yeah. Well, and you ended up with one, Julia, in your clinic.
Mm-hmm. Actually, this was one that had been being viewed by the bird watching community in this area for quite some time. And I think Rob filled me in on the back history of this bird, because it presented to us after having been found down in a field with an open fracture of one of its wings. And based on the condition of the bird, it had been down for at least a period of several days. So we have it in hospital right now, and its fracture is healing, and we're cautiously optimistic that perhaps we can release this animal back once it's completely healed. But turns out this guy had been in the area for quite some time.
Hmm. Well, at least 3 or 4 days it was in the same spot in the same field. And so a birder had found it there because there had been a snowy owl reported at Willard Airport. And so a guy who wanted to find that bird was driving those roads and found the bird that's now at the Wildlife Medical Clinic down in a cornfield. And for, I think that was New Year's, the day before New Year's Eve, maybe.
Yeah.
And then by about the third day, when birders were reporting the bird in exactly the same spot, somebody said, hey, there's something wrong here. We got to, find out what's going on with that bird. And sure enough, it didn't go anywhere. And I believe it was some of the field group that works with Mike Ward who went out and captured that bird and then took it into the Wildlife Medical Clinic.
Mm-hmm. And what's interesting is actually we've seen some of the photographs that were taken of that bird, and if you look closely you can appreciate that one wing is drooping, so there was evidence of the injury. Mm-hmm. But obviously out of respect to the individual animal and also to keep individuals safe who are viewing the animal, we don't encourage walking up on these birds, but unfortunately he was down injured.
Yeah. Well, that is one of those things that I know you always caution people about approaching any animal that's injured, because you don't want to hurt the animal, you don't want it to hurt you, and it's the kind of thing that is best left to a professional.
Often, yes, but it's always amazing to me how many people ignore that and bring us in animals that by all means should have caused some harm to their finders, but yeah, it's successful.
Well, so what is the thing that you would suggest to people if indeed they have that kind of situation, they see an animal that they are pretty sure that it's hurt? What do you tell people to do?
Well, that largely depends on the type of animal that they're finding. I would argue that even the most benign-looking prey species can have some means to protect itself. And also what can happen is, in the attempt of a person trying to capture that animal, the animal can injure itself further. So being prepared, first of all, making sure that you are doing something that's within your comfort zone, having a container or a carrier or a box, a blanket, something to shield yourself and to sort of scoop the animal without handling extensively into some confinement, and then getting it to a licensed facility as soon as possible. It's actually against the law for people to keep animals for any duration of time without appropriate permits issued either by the state or through the federal government to provide care for these animals. And we really recommend that people not try to feed these guys. Unfortunately, we get a lot of animals in every year where the finder has kept them for a variety of reasons for a period of time, and doing what they think is right, feeding them a variety of foods that aren't appropriate for that species or may actually harm them. So, the best thing is to get the animals to a professional.
Yeah, I guess if it was me, I think maybe I would be more worried about, not so much worried about that I would get injured. I think I would be worried about that I would somehow hurt the animal, because I wouldn't know really what would be the right way to do it.
And I think a lot of people are sometimes reluctant to bring animals into a facility like the Wildlife Medical Clinic because they're concerned the animal will be euthanized. And the thing to remember about these guys, even the snowy owl, who I understand because he's an Arctic species and not really innately afraid of people, he's actually quite calm in captivity. But even an animal like that is not necessarily always appropriate to be kept in captivity. So when we have a patient that comes in with an injury or an illness that is severely debilitating and resulting in that animal never being releasable, we're going to elect the most humane care, which in some cases is euthanasia. So I think people find that very sad and disturbing, as do we. It's never something we enjoy doing, but we always have to keep the animal's best interest in mind.
Yeah. There's something beautiful about old birds. So even your grackles and starlings. I'm not sure about starlings, but the grackles. I'll give you that one. But there's something about owls. And I'm not, I think I know what it is, but there's something about them that is particularly striking, and that they make an impression on you.
I agree.
They certainly do. I talked to a colleague of mine who had been out at the Champaign County Forest Preserve District's owl prowl last evening, and he said that they called in a barred owl and just talked about what an amazing experience that was for himself and for his son, who's 3 years old. And that's just a very different kind of bird. This is a wonderful time of year to see owls, too, because they're very active along the Sangamon at Allerton Park near Monticello, or at the Riverbend Forest Preserve, or anywhere you have a wooded riparian corridor right now. You can have a pretty good shot of seeing barred owls late in the afternoon. They're out and about.
Yeah. I love the picture. There's a picture of Julia that's on their website, the picture of her, and she's holding in the palm of her hand an owl. What kind of owl is that?
She is a saw-whet owl. She's the smallest owl that we have naturally in this area.
So what's the story of that bird?
Well, her name is Noelle, and while my students name most of our patients, it's not something we encourage. But Noelle is named because she presented to the Wildlife Clinic about 3 or 4 years ago because of an inability to fly. And through a series of diagnostic testing, we were able to ascertain that her injury resulted in a paralysis of her wing. So she has a permanent wing droop and an inability to fly. And again, the Wildlife Clinic is not necessarily in the business of housing animals. We try to get them healthy and then released. But we do have a strong education program, and we maintain, with federal permits, about 5 birds of prey who live at the clinic and who go to classrooms around the community, scout troops, special events. You can see them at various events around the community during the summer especially, where they are ambassadors to their species, to the work we do at the Wildlife Clinic, to just a nurturing of a concern about nature. And so she is one of our resident birds.
Yeah, it's a wonderful picture. I like it a lot. And I guess the thing it was actually Harriet, my producer, she said, well, you know, the thing about owls is that their eyes are right in front. They look at you. Mm-hmm. They give you that I'm looking at you look. And other birds, because their eyes are on the sides of their heads, they can look at you sideways. But they're not like a person that looks at you that way. Mm-hmm. And the owls can have a certain look. They give you that look that makes it look like they're looking right through you.
Well, and even in addition to that, Noelle, for instance, our saw-whet, she has these beautiful long feathers around her eyes that she's just sort of slowly bats at you, Marilyn-esque, you know, and so you're like, oh, wow, that's something. And then, of course, Rob was talking about the barred owls, and they have that solid black eye that just sort of makes you wonder what they're thinking. So it's really interesting.
Is there something, you know, particular about owls that you you think makes them magical?
I think all birds are magical. So it's one of those ones that and I was thinking about, though, the owls and the other birds that I get most of my photographs of, especially at this time of year, are birds of prey. And part of it is that they're big and they sit still. Owls can be difficult to spot when they're roosting during the day. And I'm really bad at finding them, in the trees. I'll be with other people and they'll say, "No, it's right there in the top of that cedar." And I'm like, "Really? Because all I see is branches." But, once you locate owls or hawks or falcons, a lot of times you can get them sitting in the same place for a while. And so you get to that long look at them that you don't get later in the spring when the birders are out, watching warblers and you're craning your neck and you're getting a 3-second look at something.
And will
lucky.
Not sit still.
And they will not sit still. Yeah. So yeah. I like that about the owls because we're seeing them, we see them during the down part of their day.
We are talking this part of the show. We have been talking a little bit about birds, and if people want to engage in some bird talk, that's great. If people also have questions about wildlife, what happens at the wildlife clinic, that's great. I want to talk about the beauties of the Central Illinois environment. That's great. We could do any and all of that as we talk some more with Rob Cantor and Julia Whittington. And I have some email here I'll do. I have a caller here I'll do. Let's do one more thing. Kimberly Chronic, let's encourage people to support the station.
Sure, that would be great. You can do that right now by calling in your pledge at 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org. David, you said that owls were striking and make an impression on you. We hope that this program and WILL is striking and makes an impression on you. And if you're a regular listener, we know that's the case. And we're asking you to take that one extra step if you haven't already. It'd be one of 400 people who call during this mini drive. It's just 4 days. And you know what? Every pledge you make during this drive, our business partner, Common Ground Food Co-op, will donate the equivalent of 8 meals to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank, which serves 14 counties. So you're going to have quite an impact today when you call. And David, we have a couple of folks to thank. We did have some callers who made pledges. In the first hour of Focus, we had want to thank a caller from Tolono. We want to thank Nancy from Bloomington. They both called in. And we thank you for your calls. If you're listening in Bloomington and haven't yet called, or you're in Urbana, or you're maybe listening through our web stream, that's fine too. We just want you to call in at 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org. And thanks.
So some people, maybe they say, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm making a pledge. Well, how much should I pledge? And we might say, let me see. If you tune in, how about you tune in to Focus once a week? Okay. How about give us a gift of $52? That's $1 a week.
Yeah, that's less than a coffee out.
Yeah,
that's a coffee. That's talking about a cappuccino, just a coffee. A regular coffee.
And there are people who really would say, I listen to WIL every day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Maybe you could do that. Maybe you could make a $365 contribution, $1 a day. See, the thing is, that's up to you. The amount, that's up to you. What you got to first do, make the decision, is that you're going to do it, that you're going to be the supporter. And then the dollar amount you can work out. We had dollar goals, but we have people goals. And I think the people goal is really, that's really the more important one, the people
goal. It is, because we don't want one or a few people to do it all. We're public radio, public broadcasting, so we're asking for more people to do a little bit, because some people can't do anything. And yet we still serve, through our signal, this commercial-free signal, we serve everybody. So if you can pledge right now, you're helping not only yourself and the station, but your entire community. And because Common Ground Food Co-op is partnered with us, your pledge also goes to the equivalent of 8 meals donated by the Common Ground to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. So many reasons to pledge. 244-9455. Thanks.
Okay. Our guests this morning are Rob Cantor and Julia Whittington. Rob is a communications coordinator for the U of I School of Earth, Society, and Environment. And you hear him on the Environmental Almanac on Thursdays at 4:45 and 6:45. On All Things Considered. You can also read that in the paper in the News Gazette. Dr. Julia Whittington is here, too. She's a veterinarian. She directs the Wildlife Clinic at the College of Vet Medicine at the U of I. A frog. Can you do something about that? It's a frog. And if you have questions, you can give us a call. Belgium, let's talk with this caller over in Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all. I hope I'm not going to take too much time with this statement, but I'm involved with a piece of property that I owned. I bought about 20 years ago, who I bought from my father-in-law, who owned it for about 50 years. So we've been associated with this piece of property for a very long time. And when I purchased it, we started turning it more into habitat. My father-in-law raised cattle on it and stuff, and so it didn't have quite the habitat it has now on it. But I noticed, speaking of owls, one of my neighbors had a very large tree that a great horned owl lived in for years and years and years. He decided he needed it for firewood. We've never seen the great horned owl again. It just, they won't come back once they lose their roosting spots. But the thing I was getting at, I've noticed over this change in period of time, I've developed more and more habitat, but now I have a lot more animals on my property, and I don't mean just birds. I provide a lot of habitat for birds, but now I see a lot of coyote and foxes and everything, turkey, everything is on this property now because we have a stream that runs through it, and it's just a highway. I'm sure you've realized that. Streams in Illinois are just highways for all these animals. And when I first bought the property, there were a lot of feral cats because I had a neighbor who just loved to take in any cat in the world, and she just let them run wild. But now over the time that this habitat has developed and I have more coyotes and foxes, I don't have cats anymore, which gets me to the exact point what I'm talking about, what I'd like to bring up with you. And I know it's kind for people to bring in an injured bird and have you guys fix it up, and any other kind of animal that might be. And it's kindness, I understand, but at the same time, isn't it really Mother Nature's way to let these animals just pass on along and the next generation take on?
It's interesting that you should say that, because I was sitting here while Julia was talking, thinking, like, can I say that without being too callous on the radio? And the way I would phrase it is to say, think ecologically, that a wounded animal, you know, an injured animal is part of a larger system. And that, you know, so we have a natural inclination to help the sick and injured, and that's, you know, that's a perfectly you know, understandable response. But in a natural system, you know, a wounded animal that we feel sorry for is also, you know, the food that another animal is going to bring back to help its young get through, you know, the first difficult part of their lives. And you don't want to leave an injured thing by the road. And there are sometimes, I mean, I wouldn't want to leave a snowy owl out in a cornfield either, because there just aren't, you know, that many of them around. But there are other times when you got to be, I think it's important for people to think ecologically. Does that animal need to be rescued, or is that just part of life?
Oh. Well, I want to commend you, first of all, for helping to convert the land that you own back into an ecologically friendly environment. I think that's amazing, and I wish people would do that more often. And absolutely, I think that what you've done is reestablish a natural habitat, a natural mini ecosystem, if you will, albeit it's an island in central Illinois. And I completely agree in that many times we have to let nature take its course. However, many of the animals we get in, they were not injured or harmed by a natural predator. They were affected by our human activities. And that's not to say that we should all disappear off the face of the earth and reestablish a wild land. However, I feel like the mission of many wildlife rehabilitation centers is to some degree counterbalance the additional impact that humans have on their lives. But it's also, in the wildlife clinic, we embrace the teaching of veterinary students who will go on and potentially reestablish a habitat or care for somebody's pet that they'll keep indoors so that they stop eating the birds, you know, those sorts of things.
Might I also state, well, you said it's an island. I take exception to it being an island, especially if you put these properties along a stream. They become highways. And I see a lot of animals moving up and down along this stream. And we've had many rivers. And obviously, when you get out into Champaign County, there's a lot fewer streams. But at the same time, these streams really do connect these islands you're talking about and does increase the size of the habitat that these animals have. And, well, thank you very much for your time.
Right. I would just reiterate that about the importance of streams. And in a lot of places, that's the only wildlife habitat. And it's the connection between one little island and another And that's where you see stuff. You know, that's where the wildlife is in this part of the state.
I have an email from somebody. One of the things that they were wondering about was whether there were possibility for people to volunteer to work in your clinic, in the wildlife clinic.
There are lots of opportunities to volunteer with wildlife rehabilitation. Because we're a medical facility, it's a little bit challenging because of our involvement and situation in the College of Vet Med. Certainly if you visit the Wildlife Clinic's meds website, there are some links to where people can engage in helping us. But it's a little challenging to provide the medical care if you're not associated with the College of Vet Med. But absolutely email us and we can talk about opportunities.
This person would also like to know, what was the wildest animal you have ever treated?
Boy. I would say the northern cardinals can bite darn hard. But the most unique wild animal we got, and going back to what David was saying about people catching animals safely, was a bobcat who was captured along one of the Illinois highways by these people who found it, and it had a traumatic amputation of one arm. And they just put it in the back of their car and brought it to us. And I can tell you, she was not a happy cat.
I'll bet.
So I'm glad they made it safely.
You know, I'm sure the people know that, you know, if they live with cats, sometimes they can be real unhappy and they can get you. And I'm not messing with a bobcat. There is just no way I'm doing that. They must have been very, very brave.
They were.
Or very concerned about the animal. Yeah. Okay. Let me see. What else? Oh, well, and maybe this is something we can talk about, too. Someone would really like to know what you can do if you would like to see birds and like to have them in your yard, what you can do to attract them at this time of year.
Make it habitat friendly. I mean, I think the most important thing that we've heard from our previous caller is having a natural place where they can acquire their normal food items and habitat to form nests and to hide and to avoid predators, and then also a water source. Unfortunately, sometimes we have limited ability to do that on our properties, and so we resort to bird feeders and maybe some less natural means to have animals aggregate so we can enjoy viewing them and also to provide them with the means to live. We have to be really careful with that. We recently had a situation where we had several northern cardinals present in for what we call sepsis, or an overwhelming bacterial infection, and it was from salmonella, and the likely source was a bird feeder. So we have to make sure that we're cleaning those and feeding a good food. And frankly, I think one of the biggest concerns about providing food to populations of animals is to not stop feeding them when resources become scarce, because you've called in a whole population of animals that now are relying on that food source, and if it goes away suddenly, you might have some trouble.
Well, we hope your neighbors will keep their feeders filled when you fall down on the job, or I'm talking to myself now.
Well, I think you, Julie, mentioned something that I know that we have talked about in the past when we've talked about birds, and that is, in the wintertime, if you provide a water source, you're going to see birds. And so what you have to do is you have to have something to make sure that it doesn't freeze. But I think probably for not a whole lot of money, there you can have a heated bird bath so that the water will stay liquid. And I know Mike Ward has talked about it, and that you will be amazed. If there's water, you will be amazed at the number of birds that you can attract.
I would also go back to what I said earlier about thinking ecologically, which goes to, you know, what you plant in your yard to attract birds. That some of it may be that I want to get birds out where I can see them in the winter, so I'll plant a crabapple tree that, you know, has some kind of a persistent fruit, something that hangs there through the winter, so that you know that you're going to see birds out there eating those crabapples or some kind of berry that persists. But also, you know, if you think about using the native prairie plants and other things that then provide a base for insects that are native to the region. And once, you know, you start at that level of the food web, and you make a good place for birds too. That and oak trees, so you can have which again, support the insects that the warblers come through and eat in the springtime.
Yeah. We're talking this morning in this hour of Focus with Rob Cantor and Julia Whittington, and we'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
WILL programs are made possible by Sinfonia da Camera, presenting More Mozart on Saturday, February 11th at 7:30 p.m. at Krannert. Sinfonia dedicates an evening of music to Mozart and showcases their talent as soloists and chamber performers. More information is available at 333-6280.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you here. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics every week. You can check the schedule by going to our website, which is WILL.illinois.edu. Let me mention a couple shows next week because they're kind of environmental, and they're two of our favorite people. Next week on Tuesday at 10 o'clock, Sandy Mason will be here. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension, and she's on the program every month. We talk about what grows in the home landscape. It's a little bit of a slow time, but of course, people who are gardeners are always thinking about what's out there and what they would like to plant and what's going to happen in the spring when things get going. So Sandy will be here, and maybe you still have a problem from last growing season you don't know what to do about. She can take it. And then, also that same day, Tuesday at 11 o'clock, Mae Barenbaum will be here. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She is a scientist who specializes in studying insects. And we'll talk about that. And, of course, it is the return. It's the time for, yes, it is the internationally famous Insect Fear Film Festival. It's coming again, and we'll talk about some of the movies that they will be showing. And people want to ask insect questions, they can do that. Just two of the 10 topics for next week. You can find out the rest by going to the website. You know, you could also go to the website to make a pledge. That would be a good thing to do.
That would be great, David.
Kimberly Chronic is here.
Yes.
Just tell you just how great a thing it would be to do.
It would be awesome because we're in just a four-day drive. We're in day two of that. And we want to hear from 400 listeners who become members, so that's easy math, 100 a day. David, we have 94 pledges so far, nearly 100. Because we're partnered with the Common Ground Food Co-op, your pledge also means that the co-op will donate the equivalent of 8 meals to the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. So that means 752 meals so far for the Eastern Illinois Food Bank. So that's great. It's a win-win. But the main thing is your pledge right now, 244-9455 or willpledge.org. We do want to raise $60,000 during this drive. And, you know, Julia said something. I just want to draw a parallel. She said, you know, if you're going to have a bird feeder and you're going to feed those birds and you're going to attract that population, and you got to keep feeding them, right, because you're drawing them in. Well, you know, we've drawn you in. Imagine if we were commercials. How would we survive, right? We're not commercial radio. We're public broadcasting. 43% of our funding comes from you, the listener. We've drawn you in. We rely on your support, you know, every year, and it's important to us to continue to serve you and for your help to continue to help us serve the community. So it's kind of like we've drawn you in. We have a lot of listeners, and we're asking as many of you who can to become financial contributors so we can keep going, just like those birds that you're feeding, because you want to look at them, you want to see them, you want to continue this programming. And so it's important that you do the part that you can, play your role by calling 244-9455 or willpledge.org. We'll see if that analogy works.
Yeah, we'll just trying. Torture a metaphor to the end that when we cannot push it any further. Rob Cantor is here. He is communications coordinator for the U of I School of Earth, Society, and Environment. He also does the thing we call Environmental Almanac. You can hear that Thursdays on as part of All Things Considered, 4:45, 6:45. You can also read it in the News Gazette newspaper. Julia Whittington is here, too. She's a vet in the U of I Vet School here. Doctor of Veterinary Medicine. She also is director of the Wildlife Clinic at the College of Vet Medicine here at the U of I. And again, as she has explained, that's the place where sometimes people take injured animals. They try to help them out, fix them up. Hope the idea is sometimes that they can go back out in the environment. They can't always, but that's their goal. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. You have questions about birds or the environment of Central Illinois, you can give us a call, and we'd be very happy to talk. What do you know, Rob, I every once in a while, I guess, or periodically over the time we've been doing this, I think we've tried to do shows that aimed at getting people to appreciate the environment around us. And you know, you guys both know, that there are people who come to Central Illinois and they say, man, what is up with this place? It's just flat. There's nothing here. And you say to them, I'm sure you say to them, no. See, you're not looking carefully here. You really got to look. What are you, for somebody who says to you, you know, what is there that's really fascinating and compelling about this part of the state? What do you tell them?
I run into that a lot myself. And maybe at some point I felt that way myself, but it's difficult for me to think that way now, just because, I mean, you start with the birds that you can see when you walk out the door. And you continue with the insects in your garden on your native plants, and you know, go on to... It's difficult to know where to stop. I think, you know, an appreciation of the natural world doesn't require mountains or oceans, you know, that we have streams that are good habitat for wildlife and wonderful places for people. So, you know, if you get out on the Middle Fork River or the Salt Fork River or the Sangamon River, all three of which are accessible to us, you get a sense of what's there in the state. In this part of the state,
Julie, are there particular favorite places of yours to go around Champaign-Urbana?
You know, what constantly amazes me is how short of a distance, even if you don't want to just look in your backyard or in the field next door or at one of our local parks, within a very short amount of distance, you can get to some really beautiful natural areas, whether they're state parks or just areas of different counties that offer a unique landscape. I know just over in Indiana, there's a series of limestone potholes or pools of fresh water that sort of have developed from stream erosion. And you know, just finding those places, taking the time out of your day to go exploring off the beaten path, per se, and it's amazing what you'll find. And just taking the time to look, we can see mink, we can see deer, we can see all sorts of mammals and reptiles even. I think reptiles are some of the species that we hardly ever see because they're so good at hiding. I've worked a little bit with some of the researchers on campus looking at some of the snake populations around Allerton, and they've told me that you could walk right over these animals and never know they were there.
Or spend days looking for them and not find them. Mm-hmm. But even to go back to town, I felt I wouldn't want to get out of town so quickly. So to think about reptiles, the house where my family and I formerly lived in Champaign, right in the central part of town, had a spot where the sidewalk had been heaved up by a silver maple tree. And that became a hibernaculum for garter snakes. So we knew every year, and there was another spot, you know, under the floor of our garage, a brick floor of a garage, where the garter snakes stayed over the winter. And we had a great population of garter snakes there in our yard, you know, just because we had these little pockets of things. And I think birders also know that you don't need high quality, what appears to humans to be high quality habitat. You just need the right combination of food and places to hang out. So, for instance, where Julia's at the wildlife medical clinic, not 100 yards away, there was a white-faced ibis last spring in the muck behind the dairy barns. And every year there are shorebirds by the tens of different species that hang out there, but good numbers, hundreds, you know, sometimes. A flooded farm field is all birds need for a stopover. You look at Busey Woods, which is in town here, and during spring migration, when warblers and the other songbirds that are migrating from Central and South America are headed to the northern forests and Canada, you think about the world from their perspective, and they're flying over Central Illinois, and it's like, man, cornfield. Trees, you know, and the city to them is it's a forest that it may have some houses that are stuck in there, but you know, we have, I mean, so we are all over habitat for them.
Yeah, I'm really interested in shorebirds, and I think it's amazing that you can actually see them. You think shorebirds, okay, you got to go to the coast. But because we have this major flyway here down the middle of the country, you actually can see, you know, at particular times, you actually can see shorebirds in Champaign County. But that just sort of amazes me.
And you know, we getting back to some of the purposes of the wildlife clinic and having the ability to help nature, maybe species or individuals who aren't always the weakest of, you know, we get every year a variety of different grebes and loons that just happen to land on a road and they can't take off again. So by checking them over, reconditioning them, getting them back out, we can move them on their way and you know, add to yeah, perhaps that population.
So they have to have a water takeoff?
They do.
Okay. Let's talk with the caller here in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Hi there. Yeah. As a mail carrier here in Champaign, and therefore an amateur birder, I've noticed in the past few years an abundance of crows in the urban environment here in Champaign, and I just didn't understand why they were getting to be so many in the area, and how many of them can this area support?
Is that something that you
I'm talking? Afraid to think of how many this area can support. I noticed them this morning as I had gone out for a run, and the crows were commuting from their roosts in town and I out into the fields to feed. And, you know, it's, again, I'm going to sound like a broken record. If you think about it ecologically, we provide the roosting sites that they need in town, the trees where they're comfortable all roosting together, where you don't want to have your car parked underneath or live underneath. And then we have great places for them to eat out in the fields where there's all the, you know, whatever leftover, you know, whatever grain doesn't actually make it into the harvester is there for the crows to come out and get every day.
Well, interesting. Yeah, it's just in the past 3 years or so, it seems that the population has tripled, and I do see them out my door in the morning in town, and they are leaving their roosts and thinking, where are they all going?
They're going out to feed in the fields. Crows are interesting because they're very susceptible to West Nile virus. I guess I should leave that to Julie.
You're doing my job.
And I heard, I remember hearing that their numbers were knocked way back. And It was you know, again, the observation of individuals doesn't count all that much, because I was like, boy, I never stopped seeing a lot of crows, or I didn't think I did, but apparently the numbers were down for a while.
They were, and they certainly, being fairly good at scavenging and making do with a variety of different habitats, they can be successful and, in fact, have come back. And I don't know the numbers. I'm sure that censuses have been done that have showed us a variation in their population size, but I would concur that it did seem like for a few years the numbers were quite low, but they've rebounded.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It certainly is the case that birds like crows, hawks, owls, vultures seem to have accommodated themselves to living around humans, because I think in urban areas we're seeing more of these birds than we have in the past.
Some species. Certainly there are species who have adapted extremely well. I think you just have to drive down any interstate in Illinois and you can count. You have to use your hands and feet to count the red-tailed hawks and the American kestrels that you see along those roadways. And I personally think that's kind of cool. But, you know, somebody who has a flock of chickens may not think it's so nice.
Well, we've created that wonderful habitat for red-tailed hawks and American kestrels with the roadsides there.
I want to try and get one more call real quick here. Line two, Champaign. Hi.
Hi. I think all you need to do is follow the schedule of the garbage pickup, and you know where the crows are. I've noticed in our area that these crows are smart, and we have garbage pickup by different companies, and they come on a Monday, and they come on a Wednesday. And every other day, there's no crows around. On those days, the crows are there, because more and more people, when they lose their garbage can lid, are not going out and buying a new garbage can. They just put the can out without the lid on, and the crows know this. And it's like clockwork. Monday and Wednesday, they're in our whole subdivision, just flocks of them because it's garbage day.
Well, see, and I think that's another example of how these animals have adapted to us. And crows especially. Studies have been done that show that they are actually quite adept at tool using and communication, and they're quite smart. So,
and they can recognize faces. Yes. There's been some really interesting research done on that they actually are capable of telling one person from another. And particularly if one person hassles them, they remember. And they will recognize that person, and they will remember that. They're I think, some of the most intelligent birds that there are. You know, I want to thank the caller. I want to thank everybody. We're going to have to quit because we're here at the end of the time. But it was nice having you both, and so maybe we should find some opportunities we can talk again. I'm sure we'll have Julia over again. We'll like to have folks from the vet school to talk about companion animal care and the wildlife.
That's always my pleasure.
Julia Whittington is a doctor of veterinary medicine, U of I Vet School. She's the director of the Wildlife Clinic. And Rob Cantor, you can look for the Environmental Almanac Thursdays, 4:45, 6:45 on WILL AM, also in the News Gazette. He's communications coordinator with U of I School of Earth, Society, and Environment. Thanks, Rob.
Thanks, David. It was great to be here.